Committee, welcome everybody here this morning. We've got several public hearings, and we've got floor session at 10:30, I think, today. Isn't that right? Somebody tell me, so I want to make sure we get started, get through our agenda this morning. Since we are in public hearing, we'll begin with less than a quorum, which we are permitted to do, and I'll open a public hearing right from the top on House Bill 2031. And welcome Bob Castagna and Philip Kennedy Wong to come forward while Lisbeth walks us through the bill. Oh, where's Phil?
He'll be right back.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Lisbeth Martin Mahar with the Legislative Revenue Office. Now, with House Bill 2031, this is dealing with the Earned Income Tax Credit, and it changes then the percentage of the federal Earned Income Tax Credit that Oregonians can claim on their state income tax return. And that percentage is a blank right now in the bill. I'll give you some numbers and a table there to look at the different revenue impacts. It is allowing Oregon's Earned Income Tax Credit to be refundable. And it then is going to conform the refunds that are provided to the working family tax credit that is becoming refundable now in 2003 with the refunds that would be provided with the earned income tax credit. So basically, under current law, a personal income tax credit is allowed for families that are eligible for the federal earned income tax credit. Credit is designed to help those low-income families retain income to encourage individuals to continue to work and not return to public assistance. The Oregon earned income tax credit is currently at 5% of the federal earned income tax credit, and it is not refundable, and there is not a carry forward. The amount of the federal credit allowed does decline as the amount of total earned income does increase. Now, from the preliminary 2001 data from the Department of Revenue, we find that 163,000 taxpayers claimed the earned income tax credit worth $10.6 million in 2001. That is an average tax credit of roughly $65. Now, if that 5% earned income credit had become refundable or was refundable, then you would have saw an increase in those total EIC credits claimed go from 10.6 to 13.2 with an average refund then of $81. So you're just picking up a portion of those 163,000 taxpayers that are claiming it that would then benefit from having it refundable. Now, with the table here that you have, this one basically, it just gives you some ballpark numbers there. So, you know, this applies to tax year 2004. So if you made the 5% refundable in tax
year. So we left the rate alone. We just
right,
made it refundable.
We just made it refundable. Then you would see in 2003-05 biennium a reduction of $6 million and 05-07 a reduction of $9 million. And then if you went and increased the credit to 10% and also made it refundable, then you would see a reduction of $24.4 million for the 03-05 biennium and $35 million for the 05-07 biennium. And 15%, it would be $43 million reduction in the 03-05 biennium and $62 million in the 05-07. 20%, $62 million.
No, you can stop there.
Yeah, so basically, you get the idea. And I think that's it.
Okay. For members who have not been through the earned income tax, earned income credit and refundability, I guess, Elizabeth, refundability means you get back an amount that exceeds your tax liability. So if by the tables, you would be entitled to $40 of tax credit, but you only owed $20 in tax, currently you're limited to claiming that $20. You zero out your tax liability. By making it refundable, you would zero out that tax liability and get a check for $20 in over and above what your tax liability was, right?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. So you're basically getting the check.
Right.
But it's not, again, it's not going to affect all taxpayers who claim it.
Yeah.
So I think just for a ballpark understanding, like with the 5%, if you made it refundable, it would affect roughly 87,000 Oregonians.
Okay. So of the
163,
okay, 87,000.
Yeah, I'm giving you
the credit limited. Okay.
Correct. And that's 04.
Okay.
So we are seeing a growth in the number of taxpayers claiming the EIC credits each year.
Okay. Well, with that then, for introduction, welcome, Bob Castagna, Philip Kennedy Wong, whichever one of you wants to start first.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, for the record, Bob Castagna, representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. Thank you for holding this hearing on House Bill 2031. This is the continuation of more than a 14-year discussion on the earned income tax credit concept. The legacy Richard Yates report of October 1988 has been submitted to you. We trot this out every 2 years to remind us of the rootedness of this discussion. And the goal in bringing this issue forward, tied to federal income tax reform going back to 1986. And the goal of the 86 federal income tax reform was to excuse those below the poverty level from having a tax obligation. That has been accomplished at the federal level successfully. It has not been accomplished successfully entirely in Oregon. So the reason we keep bringing this back to you is because we're still working toward that goal at the state level of trying to excuse from a tax obligation those below poverty. And the idea behind the federal earned income tax credit was to help lift families, particularly with children, out of poverty. We have done some significant things in the past here with respect to low-income families, particularly on child credits and making child care credit refundable. The earned income tax credit is an area we believe that needs additional focus. And as we requested during the interim, when the Interim Revenue Committee introduced this bill, we bring this concept to you today if this legislature engages in revenue restructuring. Given the difficulty that this state is having with revenue and the human service programs and educational programs that need funding, at this point, we don't come before you asking this to place this as a priority above funding adequately human service programs and educational programs. But if, however, the state does engage in revenue restructuring, then we urge this to be a part of that revenue restructuring. The first bill was introduced in 1989, and that's contained behind Mr. Yates's report. It was Senate Bill 249, introduced in 1989. Finally, in 1997, the Oregon legislature did pass Senate Bill 388. It was Chapter 692 of the 1997 Oregon laws. And I had a running conversation during those 8 years with Mr. Richard Munn, who at that time was the director of the State Revenue Department. And the conversation went something like this: Richard, are you working on my favorite project? And he said, Bob, I stay up nights thinking about your favorite project, the earned income tax credit. Well, it did take 8 years, and the legislature did, in fact, enact an earned income tax credit at 5% of the federal earned income tax credit, on a non-refundable basis. The other document that I've handed to you is a March last month report from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. As I recall, at the time that Oregon adopted the state earned income tax credit, we were one of a handful of states, maybe six or seven, that moved in the direction of adopting a federal, a state earned income tax credit as a percentage of the federal earned income tax credit. If you look on the front page of this report, the first bullet in the left-hand column, 17 states now offer state EITCs based on the federal credit. In addition, two local governments, Montgomery County, Maryland, Denver, Colorado, offer local EITCs. If you turn to page 4 of this report, you will see Table 1, which is a chart of those states offering refundable credits. So from having been one of the handful, five, six, seven states that initiated state earned income tax credits, now 17 states offer EITCs, of which 12 offer refundable credits. And you can see the percentages there from Ojai in Wisconsin of 43% with when a family has three children. New York offers 30%, Minnesota up to 33%, and these are refundable credits. District of Columbia, 25%. So a number of states, driven in significant part, I believe, by welfare reform, which has encouraged families to move from welfare to work, have adopted these to assist families to move not only from welfare to work, but to move out of poverty. And from the Oregon Catholic Conference's perspective, that, we believe, should truly be the goal of welfare reform. Not only to move families from welfare to work, but to help families move from welfare to work and out of poverty. And the EITC, because it benefits those who are working, helps achieve that goal. If you look at the charts now of the non-refundable states, we are, and I admit, we are one of 17 states that has an earned income tax credit, so that is to the good. But we have fallen behind the progress of states that have adopted earned income tax credits. So again, we bring this issue before you, motivated in significant part by what the U.S. Catholic bishops said in 1986 when they authored the Economic Pastoral Letter. In that, they held forth three criteria for economic decision-making. And the three criteria run to the effect of, what does the decision do to the poor, what does it do for the poor, and how do the poor participate in that decision? So again, we bring this issue in the context of realizing the state of Oregon has tremendous revenue problems. But if the state engages in revenue restructuring, a la House Bill 3500, looking at a sales tax, and we appreciate that a refundable earned income tax credit is part of that proposal, we would ask you to give this serious consideration and to move it to the top of the list in terms of revenue restructuring if we're going to adopt a new form of revenue for the state of Oregon, that this should be a part of that mix so as to take into effect a number of goals, moving people and families and children out of poverty and also helping to eliminate those below the poverty level from having a tax obligation.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear from Philip and we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Revenue Committee. I will try to keep my comments brief, as many of the points that Bob had raised, I mean, although they're worth mentioning, I'll try to keep it brief and mention other aspects of this. The goal of a refundable tax, state-earned income tax credit, is to bring families closer to or above the poverty line. And we see House Bill 2031 as a measure to relieve the tax burden on low-income families. And although we concur with, you know, the Oregon Catholic Conference that, given the situation of our state, you know, economy, it is very tricky to talk about tax credits or earned income tax credits in a time like this. However, I would also want to toss out there that when money is brought into people who need it the most, low-income families, the money does go back into the economy in terms of acquiring and purchasing services that low-income families need, including food, shelter, so on and so forth. So with that, we want to thank you again for having this hearing on House Bill 2031, and do consider that you take a look at it as part of a larger examination of our state tax system. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for either of these gentlemen? I have one. I guess looking at the numbers that Elizabeth gave us this morning, taking our 5% and making it refundable, looks like it increases the average credit amount from $55 to $81. It's a $16 increase. That's not a big increase. I'm curious, if you had to trade off making the credit refundable at 5% or, let's say, increasing the percentage, not making it refundable, but increasing the amount that can be claimed, which would you prefer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the issue of refundability is so important for low-income families that I think, from my own personal preference and not looking at any numbers other than the tax expenditure report, I would move in the direction of refundability to establish that precedent and match it up with the child care credit, which was made refundable, to move in that direction. As I look at the tax expenditure report for 2003-05, the bulk of people who receive the credit, 77.6%, according to this report, are earning below $22,000 a year. and the recredit. This is the statement as to who benefits in the 03-05 tax expenditure report. In 1998, about 156,000 full-year resident taxpayers claimed an average credit of $64. In 2000, the number of claimants declined to 148,000, while the average claim increased to $66. Because many of the families claiming the credit do not have sufficient tax liability to use the full amount of the credit, the average tax benefits for 1998 and 2000 were $45 and $46, respectively. So these are people who are working, who in large measure, according to this report, are earning less than $25,000 a year. We think that those who have a credit need every dollar that can come to them. So our preference would be to move in the direction of refundability to get to the lowest income working workers.
Any other questions? All right, thank you very much.
We have John Lewis.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Lewis from the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I will be very brief. I don't want to repeat what's already been said, but I would like to say that refundability is definitely a higher priority. The people who would be most affected are making actually well under the 22,000 that Bob Castagna mentioned. These are folks at very low income levels. Many of them are struggling to meet all of the expenses necessary to have work and keep work. In my free time, I do voluntary tax preparation for folks, and I've actually run across a number of people who would benefit from a refundable credit. Even one as small as a 5% credit, I think, would make a big difference for these folks.
Okay. And this is your report?
Yes.
Executive summary that's been distributed to us. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Lewis? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks for your report. I have a note here for Patty Whitney Wise and Sam Merlin. Pardon? I'm sorry, I'm reading what I've got in front of me here.
My handwriting, sorry.
I think it's your handwriting has been transcribed, but okay, anyway, sorry.
I'm Patty Whitney Wise, the director for the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and we have been a strong supporter of the refundable earned income tax credit as well as expanding it because it affects the lowest income working families in our state. And in fact, we in the state of Oregon tax our lowest 20% of workers more than our highest 20% of workers by about a full percentage point when you take state and local taxes into account. So their burden is actually higher than the highest income people in our state. And we feel it's an equity issue. And it's also an issue of being able to put food on the table. By receiving a credit like this, it helps them meet their basic expenses, especially when they're below poverty wage, below poverty level wages. So we're very strong supporters of this. As you know, we're number one in hunger. We're trying to bring that number down. This is one way. This gives them some more disposable income to help put food on the table. So we're very strongly in support of this measure. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Merton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Merton, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Food Bank. The Oregon Food Bank has also been a long supporter of both the federal and state earned income credit, and we've really recognized that it's a valuable tool to helping alleviate hunger and lift families out of poverty. We, like the speakers that came before me, would really prioritize the refundability of this credit. We recognize that we are one of a handful of states that continues to impose a tax burden on people that are making lower than poverty level wages. So I think our second priority, if I can name two, would be to increase the credit to 12%. If we were to increase the credit to 12% of the federal earned income tax credit, we would eliminate that tax burden on low-income families. We believe that refundability alone, if you could just take that page one of this bill and mark in the same 5% on the blank that you have for the percentage and pass the bill, we would have a refundable earned income credit, and that alone would be a great step forward. A number of the families that we see at the Oregon Food Bank and our member agencies all across the state are working families with kids. Our last Hunger Factors report in August showed that 42% of the families that are getting emergency food boxes are working, and over half of them are in households with children. So these are the very same families that are working families that are really struggling to make ends meet, and this is a really valuable tool to helping alleviate that burden on families. So that is all I have to say, and I urge you to pass the bill.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for either of these witnesses? All right. Thank you for coming forward. Does anybody else wish to be heard on House Bill 2031? All right. With that, then, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2031. And I have Representative Barker here on 3423. Were we going to give him a call? Brian DeLashmit. Brian, are you here? Okay, you can get us started. Let me open a public hearing then on House Bill 3423. And while we bring Brian DeLashmit up and give Representative Barker a call, do you know where he is, Kathy? Okay. Mazin, would you please talk us through the staff summary?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this bill opens the exemption from property taxation to a homestead of a surviving spouse of a public safety officer who was killed on the line of duty or while interceding in crime while off duty. This bill goes in the same lines with the public safety officer definition in the statutes. This applies to correction officers, firefighters, firefighters, both professional and volunteers, parole and probation officers, police officers, and youth correction officers. This allows local districts to grant property tax exemption of an amount and duration that is determined by that district. However, it does not compel one district, such as a district that for example, the officer was working for, to be the one. It could be any one of those districts around. Also, it doesn't have the clear compelling, if you will, of all the districts in one county, let's say. And it also it gives the eligibility exemptions for the public safety officers, spouse at the time of death or 2 years after death, and if a move from one house to the other happens, then the same amount that was granted originally could be transformed. It also allows or puts forward the disqualification factors for this exemption, and it lists them, about six of them, as you have in the staff report. And the process, the only thing in the process is that might be an independent process of application of determining who is eligible or who's not. This has not been connected entirely with the Memorial Fund, as known. At this time, there is 11 beneficiaries of the Memorial Fund that is in the statutes. There is estimate of about two additional beneficiaries a year of this exemption.
All right. Good morning, Representative Barker.
Morning, Representative.
It's yours.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jeff Barker, and I represent District 28 in Beaverton, Iowa. And House Bill 3423 was an idea brought to me via your former colleague, Randy Leonard, Representative Randy Leonard. And it came out of Essex, Maryland, from a man named Frank McCrotty. He's retired and since September 11th has been looking for ways to honor police officers and firefighters. And with the help of some of our legislative peers in Maryland, that law is now in effect in Maryland. It's passed and they're also being discussed in other states. I know I don't need to give you a long speech about the debt we owe fallen police officers, firefighters, corrections officers, and parole officers, but in your consideration of the bill, I ask that you remember the emotional and financial impact on the loss of that person in the household has for the families. This bill would give Oregon cities and counties the option, and this is the important part of this, the option of granting surviving spouses and public safety officers who die in the line of duty property tax exemptions. In this bill, the amount and duration of the exemption is determined by that county or city. I realize that during this current fiscal status in Oregon, the timing might seem a little bit odd, but as you know, in order for a taxing district to have the option, it must be in the Oregon statute. I spoke with the Association of Oregon Counties, and although property tax exemptions are not higher on their agenda this session, they do not oppose the legislation precisely because it is an option, not a mandate. We talked about things like sometimes there's federal money that comes to the fallen public safety workers, but it may take a year for them to get it. While the family is in need of it, the county or city could grant the exemption for that period of time, and then they could cancel at the end of the year. Or they could see if a family has plenty of assets, it would be their option to not grant an unneeded tax exemption. But other families that do need it, they could allow it. And that's the main point. It's optional. It's there to really help people who need it. And I'm asking you today, colleagues, for your favorable consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Barker? Representative Verger?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, what all happens when a police officer is killed in the line of duty? Is there added insurance at that time, or is there...
There's normally some federal insurance, but sometimes that takes as long as a year for all that to be processed and to kick in before the family sees any money. There may be local insurance. I know when I was in that line of work, I personally carried additional insurance, term insurance, so that my family would be provided for.
And there's the police officer's memorial fund now that provides. Oh, you're going to talk about that? Okay.
Yeah, there is the memorial fund as well, but those are things that could all be considered in the mix as to whether the county or city, the local taxing authority would grant that.
And perhaps this is going to come out in the testimony. I guess my other question is what would be the amount of the federal insurance that's paid?
Anything else for Representative Barker? All right, thanks. If you need to get back to committee.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for coming down. Brian DeLashman.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. Representative Barker approached me on this bill, and actually, quite frankly, in the entire stack of 3,000-plus bills, I hadn't noticed it, which surprises me because I'm usually pretty good at picking through the bills. But after I looked at it, an initial reaction, which is the timing may in fact not be that good because of, obviously, the crisis we're going through in both state and local as far as revenues. But after I reviewed the entire bill and it looked like, obviously, there was a local option, I kind of perked up a little bit and said, well, okay. Depending on the location and the status of the officer, that local option could in fact be exercised now or in the future when budgets look better. So we are supporting the bill in its present form. Addressing Representative Berger's question, actually there is several different aspects to the fiscal status of fallen officers. Quite likely, the local jurisdiction may have a policy that they get through their employment. It may be fairly modest. I think in most cases, you're probably talking $10,000 to $25,000. Obviously, the individual officer may have, as Representative Barker indicated, their own life insurance, which can take some processing time. But if you're talking about current state and federal programs, there are two. Mr. Chair mentioned the Public Safety Memorial Fund, which we implemented several sessions ago, which I'll just make note of is defunded by 70% under the current proposed budget, but we hope to get restored. Actually does a couple of things. First thing is it's a $25,000 cash award, which in essence works like insurance that's usually turned over within about 2 weeks. That was originally designed to deal with the funeral expenses, the immediate drain on a family. Beyond that, that program does a couple of additional things. If the family does not have ongoing health and dental insurance, specifically for the children, then it instructs them if they have the available resources in the fund to try and fund that. And then the other major element of that, well, there's actually two additional. One is mortgage, payment of the mortgage for up to a year. And then the third piece is the college tuition for dependent children. There, since we've passed that, actually with the help of some of our congressional delegation, there is now a federal program that mirrors, to a certain extent, our state program. It also is a cash payout, but it is a cash payout in lump, and it usually does take about a year to get it. My understanding is it's in excess of a couple hundred thousand dollars, but it's about a year down the road. So we are currently, just so you'll know, working with DPSSD, which administers the state program, to see if we can't mesh those two programs so that resources that are drawn using the federal program would not need to be drawn on from the state program, and particularly in the area of college scholarships, which the federal program also has. So I don't believe, as Representative Barker indicated, if in fact you use the available or the option, the local option, I believe that they can do some means testing. They can see, okay, how quickly is the money coming from the state program? Do these folks have other resources, including individual insurance? And at what point does the federal dollars come in? And of course, at that point, they could either make the decision to continue or not accept the initial application for this, the provisions in this bill. And with that, I'll end and answer any questions.
Okay. Questions for, yes, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the fact that it's optional for the counties, but could you describe for me any circumstances under which you would see the county saying no?
Actually, Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, yes. You may in fact have a situation in which there's a substantial financial resource that's already available to that family, and the county or the local jurisdiction may say, well, your tax liability, to that jurisdiction is let's say $1,500 or $2,000 or $3,500, and the person in fact has already by that time gotten state dollars and the federal dollars, and they may make the determination that through means testing that that person or that family doesn't qualify. It's entirely up to the local jurisdiction. I would hope, in fact, that they don't do that, at least in the initial, the first year. But I think that's an option that the local jurisdiction would have.
Any other questions? So you see this, Brian, as a case-by-case kind of exemption as opposed to a county ordinance that just adopts all of these standards that make them automatically applicable?
Yeah, that's the way I viewed it without having extensive discussions with Representative Barker and what's been going on in other states. That's the way I would view it.
Of course, we're talking county, but I guess that's another just a technical thing. If we never get back to work on this thing, it does discuss this in terms of an exemption granted by a taxing district. Which could be we have any number of taxing districts within cities and counties. That'd be a question I think we'd have to have addressed here. Is this really just on a taxing district by taxing district basis, or like other local options, if 51% of the taxing districts agree, do you make it applicable across the board as to all property taxes?
Mr. Chair, that's the same question, one of the same questions
yeah.
I had.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for Mr. DeLashmit? All right, thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Does anybody else wish to be heard on House Bill 2423? If not, we will thank you for that and close the public hearing on House Bill 3423, if I said something else. Yeah.
34-23. All right, then let's go on down the agenda to House Bill 3301. Elizabeth, is that you again? Okay. And I have Jane Williams signed up. Ms. Williams, if you'd like to come forward while staff gives us the report.
Mr. Chairman, with House Bill 3301, this allows any person who has been granted active enrollment to practice before the IRS and who is qualified to prepare tax returns in the state may represent the taxpayer then before a tax court magistrate or the Department of Revenue with respect to the administration of the tax. So basically, under current law, it restricts it to attorneys and public accountants or an authorized employee of the taxpayer who is regularly employed in tax manners to represent a taxpayer before a tax court or the Department of Revenue with respect to the administration of any tax.
Okay.
So there's no revenue impact.
All right. Ms. Williams, good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill. I represent a constituency of around 700 enrolled agents who either live in or practice in the state of Oregon. I have before me the plaque that I normally have on my wall, which states that in terms of the history of the enrolled agents, it was in 1884 that Congress endowed enrolled agents with the power of advocacy to prepare claims against the government and to seek equitable justice for the citizenry. When the process was brought to Oregon to establish who could represent taxpayers, I believe enrolled agents got overlooked. There are four provisions in the provision at the federal level in Circular 230 that state that there are four people who can represent before the IRS. The first is attorneys, the second is certified public accountants, the third is enrolled agents, and the fourth is enrolled actuaries. As I look on the back of the power of attorney for Oregon, there is a statement here that all tax programs can be represented by an attorney, a CPA, or a designated employee, and enrolled agents are very definitely omitted in that process. The process of becoming an enrolled agent is one that involves a great deal of study and involves an exam equally difficult as the CPA exam is for the certified public accountant, but focuses entirely upon tax and upon representation procedures. As little as 10 years ago, there were a great many of the employees of the Department of Revenue who did not know what an enrolled agent was. I appeared at a hearing. The officer said, I walked in and I introduced myself. I said, I'm an enrolled agent. He said, what's that? Are you a licensed tax consultant? Apart from being insulted by it, I was also appalled that there was no knowledge of the position at the state level. And at a conference 10 years ago, there was a person representing the Department of Revenue at the society conference who, again, did not know what enrolled agents were. I have asked to be distributed to you a brochure from the National Association of Enrolled Agents, which defines an enrolled agent and demonstrates the kind of training that we have in taxation. We are required to be trained in taxation. We are tested annually. We are educated annually. We are required to propose our credentials and our continuing education annually. The addition to that, we were asked by Department of Revenue to add a friendly amendment that we also would have to maintain licensure in the state in order for us to have this privilege, which could mean that we would also be attorneys, we would also be a CPA, we would also be a licensed tax consultant or preparer. In other words, we would be allowed already to prepare returns in the state. What we are really talking about here is the opportunity for an enrolled agent to represent beyond the matters of net income tax. We are allowed to sign the return that is for the federal estate tax. we cannot represent the estate tax in the state of Oregon if there's an inheritance tax issue regarding it. And that is a disparity in terms of the powers that we have, in terms of the responsibilities that we have as well. Many of us also prepare payroll taxes, and it is a tremendous inconvenience to the Department of Revenue for us to be in a position where we have worked out payroll collection issues with the IRS. We then have the exact same issue with Department of Revenue. We contact Revenue, and they cannot work with us without the taxpayer presence. So therefore, we have to have a conference in order to solve the problem, whereas at the federal level, we are able to stand in the shoes of the taxpayer. I have taken the legislation and the information that I wrote to you individually and delivered to your offices 2 weeks ago. I took that same information to the Board of Accountancy and explained what we were proposing here. They have taken no position on it. They did not wish to make any statement on and in any direction on this because of the fact they felt it was the purview of the tax Board of Tax Practitioners, and they did not want to step on any toes there. They did, however, appreciate being informed, and they felt that this was an appropriate type of action, but and had no objection in that respect. The tax preparer board had they have been approached with this. It was taken to their brought to their attention. They reviewed it, and they did have some questions. Those questions have all been resolved at this point. It was taken to Department of Revenue. As I mentioned before, Department of Revenue had a friendly amendment to make, which we have accommodated. Their concern was that enrolled agents who were in other states might, in the original wording, have the ability to speak before Department of Revenue, whereas an attorney or a CPA in that other state would not have that same privilege. And therefore, they requested that we add the language that the person had to also be licensed to prepare tax returns in this state. And I believe this is a housekeeping issue. There are two issues for me. I personally do a lot of estate tax returns, and it is very inconvenient not to be able to pursue those issues at the state level. I do a lot of payroll tax, likewise the same problem. But it's also a matter of pride. I have a great deal of pride in having become an enrolled agent. It was no easy task. Many people take the test 6 or 7 times before they pass it because it is a very difficult test. I actually teach people how to prepare for the test, so this is something that I'm very personally concerned with. When I hand the power of attorney to my client and they see the federal return, the federal power of attorney, they see that I'm an enrolled agent. They understand what that's about because I've been educating them. When I hand them the power of attorney for the state, there's no mention of the enrolled agent, and they always question that. So I would like to have our status acknowledged by the state, and in order for it to be on the power of attorney, it has to be included in the statute. I would urge you to consider passage of this.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Ms. Williams. How many enrolled agents are there in Oregon?
There are over 700 in the area, both Oregon and the immediately adjoining cities that often have licensure in the state of Oregon as well.
Anybody else for Ms. Williams? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
See, this is put in by Representative Barnhart, who's a member of the committee and will be here with us tomorrow, as I understand, so we can talk with him about that when he gets back. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3301? All right. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3301. And Representative Merkley, yes, there you are. Must be watching us somewhere. You're watching us somewhere up there. Is that it? We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3414.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the opportunity to discuss this bill and to testify.
Okay, we'll let you go before the staff summary. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to my attention through an article in the newspaper, which we will be obtaining copies.
We've got copies.
You have copies,
yeah.
Great. that was titled Prepares Bill Poor Out of Tax Credit Money. I'll be brief so that Mr. Myers can testify. He wrote the article, and he was directly involved and very familiar with these loans. In essence, low-income individuals who are due a refund under the Earned Income Tax Credit are in a situation where, as they have their loans prepared, they're normally offered the opportunity to have these funds immediately, but the fees that go along with that are often excessive. And the result is really a perverse situation where low-income families who are in this position find an unreasonable share of their funds going to the process rather than to coming back to assist their families in the way that was intended. I'd like to note that the bill is really quite simple. It has a cap on the fee related to the percent of the loan. This is not an annual percentage interest rate because these loans might be from a few days to a few months, and that calculation is not something one knows exactly in advance. Furthermore, the process of preparing the loan is different than the process that you have for a normal loan where you do have a set period. So it sets a cap on that, and then there are several features that are needed to obtain these loans. You need a tax refund account, and normally you need to have an electronic filing of the return, and there's a fee that's associated with that. The language here just says that fee should be similar to the electronic filing fee charged to all other customers. It's not used as an opportunity to gouge individuals. And then finally says that there shouldn't be any other fee that is added on, because you can create another fee with another name in any given instance to avoid these caps. But this cap of 5% is really still quite reasonable. If you have a $2,000 loan, that would still be $100. And in addition to the fee for the account and the electronic return. So with that, I'll simply conclude by saying these are reasonable provisions to ensure the low-income Oregonians are not gouged at the moment of getting their refund loan, and I'll pass this on to the expert.
Thank you, Representative Merkley, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear at least my testimony and to consider this legislation. I spent one tax season working for a company full-time as a tax preparer. This is 2 years ago, and we were located in Fred Meyer stores. You have maybe seen similar companies set up in Fred Meyer stores. It was very retail. People would basically stand in line, come in, and have their taxes prepared on the spot. And if they were interested in receiving their refund within 24 to 48 hours, they would fill out additional paperwork for what's called a refund anticipation loan. The vast majority, in fact, in every instance that I can remember from my time there, every person who applied for a refund anticipation loan was a qualified recipient of the federal earned income tax credit. As a general rule, not as a general rule, in every instance, I mean, that is what was paying for those refund anticipation loans. It wasn't money that was coming out of their pocket. It wasn't their withholding that was paying for it. It was the earned income tax credit. Our store did about 800 returns during that season. Approximately 1 in 4 of those customers applied for refund anticipation loans and received them. The average cost on that was about $100 per person between the interest that they paid on it and the application fee. So there was $20,000 that was spent out of our store that was designated for food, shelter, health care, transportation, basic life necessities. It was never given to those people. That was, in fact, spent so that they could get the money in 2 days rather than in 2 weeks. The corresponding annual percentage rates on those loans was always over 100%. Now, House Bill 3414 addresses some of these excesses. It prohibits fees in excess of $50 for the loan application. It caps at 5% the percentage that can be taken for the interest on the loan itself, and it removes any additional fees that the customer might need to pay to have their fee, to have their tax return filed electronically and to receive the refund anticipation loan. Now, I support the bill. I think it's a great first step towards achieving at least some fairness in how the earned income tax credit is distributed. I do think, however, that when earned income tax credit was first devised, that the intention was not to pay for people to get that money in 24 to 48 hours. It was meant for basic life necessities. And overwhelmingly, the people that apply for it, like I say, are single parents. They have young children. They make $6,000, $8,000, $10,000 a year. They are being the money that the state, the money that the federal government has allocated for them to pay for those basic things is being used instead for a convenience to get that money faster. I don't think that's the intention, and I think that that should be changed. My opinion, and I know you're not asking my, well, maybe you are asking my opinion. I'll tell it to you anyway. I'm here, I'm sitting down, and I got a microphone. I believe the legislature should draft a measure prohibiting the collection of by Oregon tax preparation companies of RAL fees from the disposition of tax returns. I don't think that's the intention. I don't think that our state money, the taxpayers' money, should go to get this money to people faster. We're talking $60, $80, $100 per person. I heard in the earlier testimony on raising the earned income tax credit in Oregon about making a difference between $65 and $81. What I'm proposing would make a difference of $100.
Questions? I don't see, and I'm sorry I stepped out. I heard the testimony when I was leaving and came back in about the earned income tax credit. I don't see that specifically addressed in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not specifically addressed because the basic principles regarding the tax refund loan should apply to anyone applying. This problem has arisen primarily in the context of low-income individuals who are applying for who are in the position of earning that tax credit.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So their refunds then are because of other factors. They're not making enough or whatever. Not just because of the earned income tax credit.
My experience, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, in most cases, the individuals were only getting back their earned income tax credit. There may have been withholding, but in many cases, there wasn't even any withholding. So they're getting a $2,000 refund back from earned income tax credit. They're paying $100 for the taxes to be prepared. They're paying $100 to get that money the next day. So they're getting $1,800. So they're losing out 10% of their money just to get the fees, just to get the return filed and get it in 2 days. They waited 2 weeks. They'll only pay $100 for the tax preparation, which might even be too much, but that's for another day.
Okay, any other questions? All right, thank you very much. Excuse me. Does anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3414 this morning? No? All right, going once, twice. Closed public hearing on House Bill 3414, and we will then open a hearing on our last bill for the morning, and thank everybody for their expeditiousness with the... Oh, it's Urban Renewal Battles Part 5. House Bill 3417.
Attack of the Clones.
Mazin, try and explain this one.
All right. Mr. Chair, I think this one is going to be the antidote for the 1 hour bringing back the phone with everybody else. The bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in a way, tries to sequester about 20% of the urban renewal funds that come through the urban renewal areas and all these projects, and make those 20% dedicated to building an affordable housing. And affordable housing in this instance is defined to be the either single or multiple units that are sold to people with 50% of the median income of the county that this project exists in. The 20% requirements is not only spent on the units themselves. It could also be spent on roads, streets, infrastructures, and so on. However, there is a mechanism by which the Urban Renewal Agency could avoid spending that 20%, and that is by the county to or the area to certify that there is an abundance or an enough stock of affordable housing that exists in this area, the urban renewal area, for the coming 10 years. Urban renewal agencies will be required by this legislation to review or revise the urban renewal plans by the year 2005 to comply with the 20% requirement for the affordable housing. However, also the affordable housing could be built outside the urban renewal district or the urban renewal plan in the geographical boundaries of it. However, and it could be maintained only in the municipality that the urban renewal plan works within. However, there is a cap to that of building those affordable housing units outside the geographical boundary of the urban renewal plan. The cap is to be less than half of that total be built outside. There's not very clear at this point, these issues remain to be resolved with this legislation, is how it interacts or what is going to happen when the affordable housing exemptions start working with the urban renewal issues. That in essence the affordable housing exemptions for property taxes might take away from the urban renewal amounts both in division of tax and the other taxing districts, and bringing that 20%, probably not all of it, but at least a big segment of it out of the tax rolls because of the exemptions that exist for the different programs for affordable housing. And that's the story in short about this.
Okay, well, you pretty well cleared out the room, hasn't it?
So they woke up and left.
They woke up and left. Yeah. Nothing happening here. Let's start with Ian Slingerland and John Flatt. Actually, David Neibel, do you want to come on up? Looks like, and Representative Merkley, you're still here. So I, yeah. Fine. I want to bring up an extra chair there, David. Do you want to just take the back bench for now until we'll have a substitution after the timeout.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Urban renewal can be a two-edged sword. It can improve the quality of a community significantly, but it can also raise housing prices such that those who live there before the renewal are driven out of the community. This bill attempts to address those factors by saying that part of improving a community should be ensuring that there is a reasonable spectrum of affordable housing, and thereby dedicates a portion of the urban renewal funds to that purpose. This bill was brought at the request of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. They're the experts, and on urban renewal, you need experts. So I'll close with that, and thank you to the committee for hearing this bill.
Yeah. Thank you. John.
Great. Thank you. Members of the committee, my name is John Vlad. I'm the executive director of the Oregon of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. Wow, it's so long. I even messed it up that time. Urban renewal has been something that's been around in Oregon. Actually, Oregon was the second state to pass urban renewal districts in the country. California was the first. And for most of the history of urban renewal, its effect on housing values and housing prices was not an issue in Oregon. But in the last 10 years, Oregon has seen a dramatic rise in the cost of both rental housing and for an ownership housing. In your chart, in your packet that's being passed out back about let me find it. On the about 6 pages back is a chart that shows what's happened to housing prices for home ownership during the 90s. Basically, it's gone up about 78% over the course of time, almost doubling during the 90s. That is number one in the nation in loss of housing affordability. So the and according to the Oregon Center on Public Policy, during that same time period, rental rates went up about 52%. So, and of course, incomes, as we all know, during the 90s did not rise for the lower income quartiles in Oregon nearly as much. So the market has tightened a lot. I mean, I think that's something to emphasize. This is something that over the last 5 or 10 years has become an issue rather than something over the last 30 or 40 years. So there is a change as the market is tightening up. Things that you do to try and increase property values, which is the main objective of urban renewal, and it has been very successful at that. I mean, I think some of the best urban development projects that have been done all over the state are the result of urban renewal funding. So I'm not opposed to urban renewal funding. I just think that its impact on affordable housing has grown dramatically in the last 10 years and that we need to have some balance in our policies. One of the things that is a little that some people seem to have asked me a number of times on this bill is that urban renewal funding is actually widely used throughout the state. There's actually a chart out of a report that was done for the Portland Development Commission on the third page back that lists the redevelopment agencies and the redevelopment plans that have been developed around the state. As you can see, actually a minority are used in the city of Portland and a little less than half in the Portland metropolitan area. So it's a widely used mechanism right now is being used mostly to create jobs and create, around most of the state it's being used to create jobs. And that, again, you're increasing jobs. If you're not doing anything to support affordable housing, you're increasing the amount of pressure on the market, and you're going to drive up costs both for rental housing and for home ownership housing. And it's from that situation that we decided that we needed to look at means of addressing affordable housing through tax increment financing and urban renewal districts. The bill before you is based on a California law that was passed in the 70s and has been in effect since then and has been fairly successful in increasing the number of affordable housing units that are developed in relationship to the other development that is done with urban renewal, whether it's fixing blighted areas or creating new jobs. It has been very successful in doing that. Now, on the what the bill does, and it was described to you, it does create a 20% set aside for affordable housing out of tax increment funding. It also allows an opt-out, so it is not required. But if your area does not have a particular affordable housing problem, there is a means to opt out of that. And a number of these districts are used almost exclusively to develop business districts, and it may not be appropriate for those districts to have housing within them. So we put in the provision that if you have one of those kinds of districts that would not be appropriate for housing to be a part of, you can use some of that money outside of the district so that people have some flexibility. On the last page of my testimony, there are some amendments they had drafted in the rush to get this to the filing deadlines. There were a few problems with the bill. The major one is that in sections, let me pull up so I can check. In section 5, on page 5, section 5 and 6, and on page 6, the rest of that page, there was a provision that was included in here, not at our request, that would have required urban renewal districts to go back and reallocate funding from existing urban renewal districts, and that is just an unworkable situation. There's no way that an urban renewal district could go back and change its allocation of existing districts. So this would only apply to districts going forward from here. So that's our overview, and I thank the committee for its time.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Black? Representative Berger.
Where in the bill is the reference to urban renewals that are limited to business districts?
That is, it doesn't say specifically business districts, but the sections that are designed to do that are, let me find the section, make sure I give you the right one. Years, it is. And, well, is it in the amendments? It's, I think we changed that. The actual, the language that would be in the proposed bill is actually on the amendments in the last page of my testimony. There's a set of amendments.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at line, yeah, proposes.
Yeah, let's see if you can catch where he is here.
In the last page, on the amendments, the last page of the written testimony, starting on that page, line 14, through the end of that page, is the amendment that would allow the urban renewal project under the project provide affordable housing located outside the urban renewal district if the plan does not propose any projects for affordable housing within the district. And then the second, the clause two, which is that if you've not exercised the opt-out, saying if you've exercised the opt-out clause, that you don't have to do that either. But
well, when you say opt, it's not entirely an opt-out. I mean, the option, let me see, the exception is contingent on
certain
ability to make certain findings.
Yes.
About supply of housing at the current time and for a 10-year supply.
Yes.
So it's not entirely a local option.
It is, if you decide to move, if the local government makes a decision to pursue an urban renewal district, that's the first decision that they have to make.
Right.
And then if you make that decision and you can't meet that standard,
right,
then yeah. Then but you have to, no one's forced into doing urban renewal.
Right. But if you do go urban renewal, then this steers you into this bill unless you can fall within this exception regarding the housing supply.
Right. That's okay. Correct.
Follow up?
I'm still not real clear. Is it not in this? It's in the preferred bill, but not in the House bill as it is right now?
It was attempted in the page, in the deletions on, but it did not, when I read it, it didn't. I think it is Section 7 of the bill that was the original bill, and it didn't, when we looked at it again and discussed it with legislative council, it didn't do what we wanted it to do. So we had the amendments redrafted once legislative council and I had a chance to discuss what the objective was.
Well, like all of our other urban renewal bills, it's not a model of clarity, but that, I think, is inherent in urban renewal. Let's bring Mr. Slingerland into this conversation.
Thanks. Mr. Chair and committee members, my name is Ian Slingerland, and I'm providing testimony on behalf of the Community Alliance of Tenants. The Community Alliance of Tenants is a statewide grassroots renters' rights organization with over 1,000 members. We applaud the efforts behind House Bill 3417. The affordable housing crisis in our state is staggering, and we desperately need more resources in order to solve it. The membership of the Community Alliance of Tenants consistently highlights the lack of affordable housing as a priority for our organization. We're active in campaigns to win new resources for affordable housing and in efforts to preserve the existing supply of affordable housing. In Portland, we have found that the targeted public investment and revitalization efforts tied to urban renewal often results in the loss of affordable housing and the displacement of long-term low-income residents of urban renewal areas. As urban renewal brings new public and private investment, new amenities, and improved quality of life to neighborhoods, housing costs escalate and low-income residents are pushed out. Urban renewal's revitalization increases demand for housing in neighborhoods, and as a result, rents rise and affordable rental units are converted to condos or sold into home ownership. Tragically, many long-term residents that have lived through years of neglect and disinvestment in their neighborhoods are forced out just as public revitalization efforts bring positive changes. Low-income residents should be able to afford to stay in their neighborhoods and benefit from the opportunity and changes brought by urban renewal. In order for urban renewal to meet its promise for the low-income long-term residents of urban renewal areas, it must be accompanied by significant investment in affordable housing. The preservation of existing affordable housing, together with the creation of new affordable housing opportunities, is necessary to shield low-income residents from the escalating housing costs that are inevitably tied to urban renewal in existing neighborhoods. Creating guidelines that require a significant percentage of the tax increment created by urban renewal to be invested in affordable housing, as House Bill 3417 intends, will move us towards this goal, and for this reason, the Community Alliance of Tenants supports House Bill 3417. Included in my written testimony are some minor technical concerns that we have about the bill, but I'll just leave those for the written testimony.
Very good. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Slingerland? All right, David Niebel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Niebel with the Oregon Law Center, which is a private nonprofit that provides legal services to low-income Oregonians throughout the state. I'm here also to speak in favor of House Bill 3417. I would echo what the previous two witnesses have said, specifically about how urban renewal periodically, and especially in Portland, has had the effect of reducing low-income housing opportunities for residents in the areas that are being renewed. I think you have to only look at the statistical survey of very low-income housing produced every year by the Northwest Pilot Project to see that the number of low-income units in downtown Portland has been reduced substantially over the last 10 years, and actually before that, I believe. I think that part of the bill that's extremely beneficial is the focus of the bill on families housing people below 50% of median family income. This is a group that many of whom spend more than 30% of their income on rent, much more, or housing costs. And so they're very much in need of affordable housing. But these families are also hard to provide affordable housing for because the need for the subsidy is so deep. So I think it's appropriate to focus these scarce resources on that group in this bill. And the only other thing I would add is that I think that this might be your chance to actually address affordable housing this session. I'm not sure that the opportunity to address affordable housing is going to be before you in any other form, unfortunately. And I would also point out that the bill that you passed to deal with a projected deficit in the May forecast puts at risk some of the funds that the state has set aside for affordable housing if the income projection for the rest of the biennium comes in below a certain level, then the housing trust fund is taken to apply to deal with that deficit. So I think this is a sound approach. I agree with the need for further work and for amendments, but I would urge you to act favorably with respect to this proposal.
Thank you.
I do. I forgot to mention one part of my testimony. On the fourth page of my testimony, there was a chart of the urban renewal districts in the city of Portland. And then on the next page after that is an analysis from the census that shows changes in poverty between 1990 and 2000. And it's a little hard to read, but basically the lighter the squares are in this box, the more there was, the more of the decline in poverty. And you can see that although there's not a direct, there's no way to link it directly, the areas where there are urban renewal districts are generally the lightest areas on this map. So they saw the greatest decline in people in poverty in those districts. And the darker areas, the ones that shift out toward eastern Multnomah County, are the ones where you saw the greatest increase in poverty.
So we need urban renewal out in East Multnomah County, is that it? To reduce poverty?
We need it all over.
Okay. Any questions for these witnesses? David, just as to your comment about addressing housing needs, I thought we fixed housing with the
local option property tax bill that we passed earlier, the City of Portland bill, housing and multifamily housing, too. Shoot, I thought that was the silver, that was the silver bullet. Now we find we're firing blanks. Okay, thank you, David.
Thank you.
And gentlemen, next we have Jeff Tashman. And Jeff, do you want to bring your friend Chip Lazenby, or is he just here to score you?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Tashman, and I represent the Association of Oregon Redevelopment Agencies, AOR. As I've told you before, it's an affiliate organization of the League of Oregon Cities and represents 47 urban renewal area agencies across the state. I have written testimony.
As you're bringing that on, I'm receiving another message, and that is that Chip Lazenby is here to testify in opposition to the bill.
Correct.
Ah, I love that. He's right. Clairvoyant.
Before I cover some of the points in the written testimony, I'd like to start out by saying that that AOR, in representing urban renewal agencies, certainly does not have a policy in opposition to affordable housing. And affordable housing, as I'll mention later, is an explicit goal of many urban renewal plans. Another just observation is that while in the past urban renewal had an image of going into areas that had existing affordable housing, redeveloping those areas and making them and not providing replacement housing, that really is the past. You know, that is a practice that has not been continued. Those are sort of the old days of urban renewal, and those practices were changed for good reason. The AOR's opposition to the bill is primarily because it would limit the ability of communities to decide the local urban renewal objectives. Statutes right now require that urban renewal address conditions of blight, conditions that are preventing an area from developing properly. The approach in statute, which was extensively revisited in 1979, was to broadly define blight, broadly define those conditions that could prevent an area from developing, and require the local governing body to find what the specific conditions are in their community that need addressing. And in terms of the and so this approach of requiring 20% is a very new approach. It's not like there are other minimum requirements and that this is just an addition. This is like an entirely different approach to urban renewal. AOR does not really believe that the bill is necessary in the sense that urban renewal is a means of implementing comprehensive plans. And comprehensive plans are produced with extensive public involvement. They have to conform to statewide land use goals. And in point of fact, they're approved by the state. So the underlying policy that urban renewal addresses is contained in a document that's gotten local consideration and has already been approved by the state. Now, depending on local conditions, the lack of affordable housing may or may not be a critical condition that prevents the proper development of an area. For instance, many urban renewal plans are established to provide infrastructure for employment uses, for job generation. Now, the bill does provide, our reading says that the bill does provide that in those areas where you don't have land zoned for housing, that the agency could meet the requirements of this bill by developing housing outside the urban renewal area. We believe that's a problem because what it will do, because what urban renewal is about is it's focused on a specific area. It's meant to increase the taxable value in that area, and it's meant to do it in as short a time as it can. So spending up to 20% of urban renewal funds outside the urban renewal area is going to delay the completion of these plans, and it's going to cause the other taxing districts who are waiting for the benefits of urban renewal to have to wait longer. Now, in those urban renewal plans that are not economic developmentally oriented but focus on downtowns and other neighborhoods, affordable housing has been a key component of those. And in fact, the trend now is as communities look at their downtowns, one of the ingredients that they find missing and use urban renewal to provide is housing. So you have smaller downtowns, especially that in their commercial districts they haven't in the past allowed housing by zoning. They've amended their zoning to make them mixed use, and urban renewal is a tool for bringing that housing in. The point is that the appropriate level of expenditure for affordable housing may be 20%, it may be more than 20%, it may be less. Requiring that 20% be spent in all cases may just not leave enough resources to achieve the other objectives of the plan. Now, the bill, as far as our reading of it, does apply to urban renewal districts that are in existence before the effective date of the bill. There's a provision that requires by 2005 that the urban renewal plans be amended to include this 20% expenditure. What we think that will result in is, let's say you've had an urban renewal plan that's been in existence for 12 or 15 years, and retroactively it has to spend 20% of its money, past and future, on affordable housing. That means all it's going to be doing for the remainder of the project, conceivably, is spending money on affordable housing. So it's really going to skew the plan.
And that applies to existing and non-existing and existing non-existing plans alike?
The various levels of existence are complex indeed. But
isn't what Descartes said? Wasn't that a quote right out of Descartes?
It's a plan of being plus.
Sartre. I think it was Jean-Paul Sartre.
I had my philosophers wrong.
Okay. Section 5 of the bill says, before January 1st, 2005, each urban renewal agency with an urban renewal plan that was approved before the effective date of this act and that is in effect on the effective date has to be amended. So we do think it does go back and with bad consequences. Finally, I would repeat that urban renewal remains the best and one of the last tools under local control for economic revitalization and community development, and that it's being used throughout the state, and I will spare you the litany. We respectfully request that the committee consider the importance of the flexibility of urban renewal in meeting local objectives in its deliberation on House Bill 3417.
All right. Thank you very much. Chip Lazenby.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm general counsel for the Portland Development Commission, which is Portland's urban renewal agency, among other things. We are a member of AORA, and we join them in opposing 3417. However, Portland, the PDC is a little bit of a different animal than a number of the other urban renewal agencies around in that we are also an economic development agency, and we also are the implementer of Portland's housing housing plans and programs as developed through the Bureau of Housing and Community Development and the Housing Authority in Portland. I think for the committee's information, I think there's some things going on in Portland that I think will lend some credence to our opposition to this particular bill. This concept of dedicating a specific portion of TIF revenues for affordable housing has come up in discussions we've had with a number of significant community groups in Portland. We are currently at the forefront of Portland's no net loss plan, in which all new development and new projects as they come forward are scrutinized to see whether or not they result in a net loss or a net gain of affordable housing and low-income housing within the city of Portland proper. That's not only within our urban renewal districts, but that's citywide, and it's PDC that's bringing a lot of the funding to those. So while I think some of the witnesses that have testified before you today have talked about some unfortunate aspects of history, I think that they are history and that the city of Portland and PDC are looking forward and are very conscious and very consciously pursuing a program of no net loss of affordable and low-income housing as we go forward. Another piece that is particularly significant for us at PDC that this bill would impact is dedicating a specific amount of tax increment dollars to housing represents a tremendous loss of leverage for us. As tax increment dollars come in the door, we don't just take them and go out and spend them. We, in fact, leverage them through bonded indebtedness to create even more money. As the city's implementer of housing, we also manage community development block grant dollars and home dollars, so we bring a blend of funds to create a variety of different housing, be it low income, be it affordable, and be it or market housing. In fact, what we're finding in the city of Portland is that the most efficient way of doing this and the most economical way of doing this is to provide a mix of housing within various programs that we're doing. Locking up 20% of our tax increment finance dollars for a specific purpose represents a loss of leverage and a loss of flexibility as we seek to actually increase the amount of affordable and low-income housing that's available. Finally, let me just say that we develop these plans not in isolation, but that we have extensive community outreach. We have community advisors that are citizens advisory groups. We work with the Metropolitan Alliance for the Common Good, which is a coalition of union and tenant folks in Portland where we are discussing these things. I just think that this would represent a setback in efforts that are currently underway to increase the amount of affordable and low-income housing that's available and that will become available through our development projects in the city of Portland. Finally, just let me say that our group at PDC is also looking at a variety of other flexible funding formulas that we think is going to increase our ability to bring funding to a lot of different projects over the next couple of years. So we would ask that you, I think this is a good discussion, but we are opposed to 3417 just because it limits us so severely in how we put together financing and our ability really to achieve the ends that the sponsors of this bill are trying to get to.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions for either of these gentlemen? All right. Well, thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on House Bill 3417 as he reaches for the gavel? If not, then I'll close the public hearing on the bill. And with that, committee. Oh, Representative.
I just want to say something. It's about...
Remonstrances.
It's about what it is. Appreciate very much your efforts looking at all these tax credit bills. I know you have an affinity for the earned income tax credit refundability issue. You're on the Hunger Tax Force and others, and that we're going through this process of looking at what tax credits we can afford, which ones we cannot, which ones we have to appeal to help balance our budget. And anyway, I just think it's a good process that we're going through. And the reason I say that is because there's a bill today on the House floor that, for whatever reason, is gone outside that process, and it is one that is a tax credit for a logging equipment, which may be a laudable incentive that we should support, but it would remove the sunset on that tax credit, and for whatever reason, aside from that policy issue, it is not going through this process that you set up, and I just draw the committee's attention to that issue there, and because of policy aside, it seems like we should do things in a sort of a systematic process, and that bill has taken a detour from that process.
Who can account for all the vagaries sometimes of bill assignments? But I will say that I did have a chance to weigh in on that bill, and I did have some influence as it went through that committee, so I'm aware of it. But getting it here was not one of the things that happened.
Yes, as I understand it, had a referral to come here, for whatever reason, was rescinded.
But again, true comment, but I did get a chance to weigh in on that. I know the committee didn't, and that's not the same thing, but it's not gone entirely under the radar screen, but I appreciate your comments. All right. With that, committee, we are adjourned.